Hello and welcome to another episode of Chalk Talk, a climbing industry podcast. All right, so welcome back to episode 67 of Chalk Talk Climbing Podcast. This episode is with the climbing doctor, Dr. Jared Vagy. Jared has spent his career focusing on expanding the knowledge and practice of climbing injury prevention and rehabilitation. He started his research when there was little to no research being done, and the best recommendation for healing from a torn A2 pulley was just to, you know, take 8 to 10 weeks off from climbing and then go back to the doctor for a follow-up. Climbing injury prevention and rehabilitation has come a long way since then, and Dr. Jared Vagy has been on the scene. Now he's out with a new book called Climb Injury Free. We get to talking about the book and his contents in this episode, so for links, photos, and how to get the book, visit the episode page for this episode at www.ctclimbingpodcast.com/theclimbingdoctor. Let's just get into it, get this episode rolling. So without further ado, here is episode 67 with Dr. Jared Vagy. All right, Jared Vagy, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time, man.
Definitely, definitely excited for it.
Yeah. So we've been talking about doing this for a little bit now. I think we were in discussions like almost 2 years ago at this point. So it's cool that we finally made it happen.
Yeah, long awaited, and I'm psyched to be on the show. I'm an avid listener, and I'm excited to bring some good content to all your listeners.
Sweet. So for anybody who hasn't heard about the climbing doctor or anything that you do, let's give them a little bit of background about why they should care about what you're talking about.
Yeah. So I guess I'll first start with how I got into doing what I do now. And, you know, I went to school or went to college for track. And so I ran track in college and I had an injury. I tore my hamstring muscle and it sidelined me for quite a bit. And there was a rock wall on campus. And so that was my therapy, really. I just started climbing. And like a lot of climbers, I got hooked on it and I wanted to climb everything. And it became a huge part of my life. And it was probably the only thing that I thought about. And I went to get my doctorate in physical therapy. I went to USC or University of Southern California. And I was training pretty hard for climbing, but I wasn't really listening much to my body. And I remember
like everybody does.
Yeah, like everybody, not listening at all. And I was just psyched. I think I just wanted to climb all the time and everything. And I would like leave right after class and I'd like drive out to Joshua Tree, you know, for the weekend and come back and start class the next day. And I just remember I was on this one route. If anyone's a trad climber, they climb in J Tree or Joshua Tree. It's called Course and Buggy. It's a little bit bouncy route on some thin nuts. And there's a top out, and I had climbed like several days in a row. I was super fatigued. I was training pretty hard. And there was this final exit move that I pulled off, and I felt this tearing in my shoulder. And at the same time, I felt some tenderness in my finger. I lowered off the route. I got through it, which I was psyched on, and then I kind of continued to keep climbing through that soreness. And I think everyone that's listening now all can kind of identify, you know, you have a tweak or an injury and you just kind of keep pushing through it. And I was just so stupid. So I went home a couple days later and I started hangboards weren't that popular then. It wasn't really as mainstream as they are now as a training tool. Yeah. It was also cheap and in grad school. And the only thing I'd spend money on, I'd like buy some hexes and some nuts. And, you know, and that would be like, I'd maybe buy a cam and I'd be like, all right, I'm going to eat peanut butter and jelly for the rest of the week. So I'd go and I'd do my training on the door frame. And, you know, the little ledge on the door frame.
Oh, yeah.
Like on the top. And around the house, there was a bunch of different size ledges. And so I would just go from door frame to door frame and I'd do hangs and pull-ups and so forth. So I just remember my finger was killing me and I jumped on one of the door frames and I cranked out a bunch of push-ups and I felt a pop in my finger. And that was like, that was a realization. And I paused. I was, like I said, I was getting my doctorate in physical therapy. Like I knew that I probably shouldn't have been doing this. And I had a pause and I said, you know what? let me start researching climbing a little bit, and I want to see if I can merge my two passions. And so I started writing articles for Deadpoint Magazine, Climbing Magazine, Climb Magazine in the UK. I started doing clinics, started at a local climbing gym, and that spread to nationally, and now I do them all over the world. And then I started working with a lot of climbers after I got out of physical therapy school and got into my career. So that's a little bit of a start.
Let me ask you, because when you kind of got started, you know, researching all this, there's not a whole lot of information out there for climbers or climbing specific injuries, or there wasn't. Now we're obviously getting a lot better. But when you first started, what did you do as far as like your own research or your own, how did you get started like researching this and figuring out how climbing specific injuries needed to be addressed?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I started, and like you said, there wasn't much out there at the time. And there now it's like saturated. Now there's so much information, people don't know what to do. So it's a different problem. But at that point, like, there wasn't much out. So I had to look at different sports that utilize similar energy systems, and started to apply some of the research from different sports, from different activities into climbing. And then what I focused on was biomechanics. Because biomechanics, you know, if you like put your arm in front of you and you flex your bicep really, really hard, and then you try and straighten out your arm and you notice it's hard to straighten out your arm because your bicep's contracting, like, you don't need a research study to show that if you just relax the biceps, you can more efficiently straighten out your arm. So what I focused on a lot, you know, it's like that's pretty much biomechanics is truth. There are laws of physics, there are laws of gravity. And so what I did is I started merging biomechanics, so how the positions on the climbing wall stress different parts of the body, how that leads to injury, and then started coupling that with the research that was around at that time.
So when you were kind of looking at this, and I mean, obviously the biomechanics makes complete sense as a way to start. What sports were you looking into that were similar? I'm actually curious about that first.
Yeah, so you think about different energy systems and you think about different movements. One of the early sports I looked at was actually gymnastics. And part of it was just because it's a weight bearing exercise, you know, so a lot of times you're bearing weight on your arms, and especially some of the men's events, they deal with a lot of, dynamic strength in different positions. So I took a look at that. And then a lot of the research from warmups, and now track and field doesn't really mesh that well with climbing. Some of the energy systems are similar, you know, such as in sprints, if you're doing a boulder route and so forth. But I started looking at track and field because that's where most of the research was, where it came from warmups. And although it wasn't a perfect fit, a lot of what we do today in all types of sports has to do with how athletes warmed up in track and field. So I pulled research from those two sports, and then, you know, at that time, then climbing research started to grow. And then now that you pull up studies, now you can start finding really specific information, like exactly on different styles of rock climbing. And I've even done some article or journal reviews for specific climbing related studies.
So how are you feeling about where climbing, injury and injury prevention research is right now? Are you still just like in the infancy of it compared to other sports?
Yeah. And as far as research or as far as the actual practical application of research, because research, you have your academic end, right? And then practical application is, well, what do climbers know? What information's on the web for climbers to get?
Yeah.
Which of those are, do you have more of an interest in?
Well, really, I mean, I guess both, because both are really important, right? Like, we need to get to, and get through the research and have that research be there, and that information be there and available in order for climbers to receive it and make it a practice in their daily lives. So I guess like I'm both, really.
Yeah, I think from the research standpoint, it's building. It definitely, there's a lot of momentum. Just the other day, there's a physical therapist who's doing their residency that contacted me because they're doing a pilot research study on what's called anthropometrics, or different lengths of the fingers and different widths and size of hands and how that relates to finger injury. And there's a lot brewing. There's a lot going on right now that's starting to come up. Some great stuff over from Germany and Europe that's coming out. And I think it's really, it's past that infancy stage. I think it's in almost like the early spring stage, if you think about it, like seasonally, where the research is now, people are getting psyched on it. And now that it's Olympic sport, at least for the upcoming Olympics, there's some more justification for funding, which is always a big deal for research studies. I think from practical applications point, it used to be there was not much information about rock climbing online, about injuries specifically. Now it is heavily saturated with some good stuff and with some not so good stuff. And I think the challenge now, and this is part of the reason why I put out my recent book, but the challenge now is creating a systematic way to distill all this information. Because you can look up finger pulley injury and you can get 100 pages of Google results right now.
Yeah.
And most climbers are like, man, like I don't know what to do because now it's analysis paralysis. There's too much. And so a big push on my end is say, okay, let's simplify this into the system. You can take any exercise you want, but it needs to be a step-by-step system, a progression so that you know that you're on track. If you think about training for climbing, like you don't just go and, you know, and have no plan and have no system and work as hard as you can, do 20 days straight and fatigue out and you're likely to get hurt. You have at least a system or a plan on how you're going to try and how you're going to climb. And so that's been my real big goal is to push this system that I've developed for climbers to start to realize there's a way they can organize their rehab.
So I guess then before we get into the book, because that's one reason I wanted to talk to you for sure is that, you know, you've been able to compile this information into something that you feel is worth putting out into a cohesive book for people to read. So before we get into talking about all of that, I think maybe we should start with talking about injuries specifically, like, what climbers most likely run into, finger injuries, shoulder injuries, stuff like that, and a little bit of prevention and so on and so forth. But I think a good way to segue into that is in talking about you starting to do research or starting to try and look into this sort of stuff. I'm curious where you started. Because like we said, there wasn't a whole lot of tangible information or researched information out there. There was a whole lot of people, a lot of climbers who were just like, oh, this is what I did, or oh, I tore my finger and I took 8 weeks off and then got back on jug hauls and then started doing some light dead hangs or whatever. You know, it's just like there were like blogs about people and how they rehab their injuries. So when you approached it, where did you start in looking at injuries, rehabbing injuries, and injury prevention and all that jazz?
Yeah, well, I started a big stimulus for me to like change my approach to climbing is I started with movement. So a little bit of background, in my schooling. So I went through, undergraduate, I did a doctorate in physical therapy. So I did a 3-year doctorate year round at USC. Then I took an additional year and I did a residency program where I specialized in orthopedics. And I took another additional year, so that's 9 years total, and I did a specialization in movement science. And that is really when it started making sense to me of how I can make an impact on how climbers can rehabilitate and change their movement. And climbing is such a rare sport that it's so slow and so sustained at times. Obviously, you got to cut loose and be dynamic, and it's not always – you're not always dancing up the wall. But there's enough time to make movement pattern changes and technique changes. And that's really where I start to notice differences. And this was actually the time when iPads were starting to get more popular and the cameras on the phones were getting better and the apps were being developed to analyze joint angles. And so I would just go to the climbing gym or I'd go to the crag and just stare at climbers climbing and moving. And I would talk to some of the best climbers in the world at that time, or even back in the day, had lots of talks, you know, or even like with Lynn Hill, who's an amazing climber, and just learning from her of how she stayed injury free through her entire career, and just developing this foundation for climbing movement is really what was the game changer for me. And I just developed an entire archive of climbing movement and how it stresses the body. And from there, it started to build, and I started to then to systemize things. But relying on the movement, and really that was a big part of my fellowship training, was what drove me to get really excited about climbing. And if you think about it, it's a lot different, because I've worked a lot with different sports teams. And if you think about for soccer or football is so quick. If you're trying to retrain movement, it's kind of hard, like in the heat of things, to sprint towards a ball, think about exactly where your knee is, and then shift directions.
Right.
For climbing, if you're warming up, or if you're, you know, it's maybe not on your project, but if you're warming up on something, then you have plenty of time to make those constant or conscious changes, and a slight shift in your body can unload an area significantly. And even these changes in technique can put you at a lower risk for injury.
So I'm going to give you a really broad question, and I'm sure it's not going to be easily answered with a direct answer, but what are climbers doing wrong then in like technique? Like what's causing the most injury to climbers when it comes to movement technique, stuff like that? What are you seeing?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different movement patterns. I can start with the simple and then build to the more complex.
Sure.
But simply, you think of like, let's say, early stage climbers. It's the first 2 years of climbing, and especially with someone with a strong upper body. What do you think, you know, John, what do you think their main issue is going to be? A newer climber, let's even say male, let's stereotype them, large upper body. They're climbing with a cutoff shirt in the gym, you know, to show their muscles. What do you think their issue is going to be?
Well, lack of footwork. They're going to be trying to muscle their way up through, you know, any move they can, trying to campus to impress all the ladies. You know, really just trying to skip moves in dyno to show off to their ladies and bros that they're stronger than all the rest of them.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so exactly. So I call it almost like gorilla climbing, and you're using your upper body heavily, and you're not utilizing footwork, and combined with that, you're over gripping. And so, you know, the analogy I like to use, I used this earlier, but like I said, if you make a bicep and you tighten your bicep as tight as you can, and then you try and straighten out your elbow, it's really hard. Yeah. But if you just let your elbow go and you straighten it, it's easier. And so I'd classify that type of climber. I'll say, okay, that's a gorilla climber. And sometimes you actually have to do that. Sometimes you got to muscle up routes. That's important, but you can't do that on every route. So that's one type. And now I'm going to give you another kind of contrast. So let's say someone has a gymnastics history. You know, I'm stereotyping, so I apologize for gender stereotypes and you know, anthropometric stereotypes and so forth. But let's say someone has a gymnastics background. They're female. They're very mobile. They can, like, I can't even squat down and get my knee out to the side. Like, they can do full splits. They can reach their arm around their body and shake their opposite hand, so on and so forth. Let's say they're a newer climber as well. What do you think they're going to be doing in the gym that potentially could be harmful?
Gosh, I mean, watching some of these kids come out of gymnastics and climb, I'm not sure harmful, but I notice a lot of times they overanalyze climbs, and they kind of get stuck halfway up the wall, and they spend a lot of time trying to figure out body position and foot movement. But I'm not sure how that would be harmful, if that's what you're alluding to.
Well, yeah. So what you'll see, you're going to see more static movement, right? So you're going to see more pauses, lack of momentum typically. And then you're going to see that they utilize range of motion. So they're going to be in these like really spread hard positions to shift or transition from, because they have the range, they have the mobility. And if you have the range, you think about it, if you're fully reached out, your arms and legs are fully spread.
Yeah.
You have to be super strong to be able to stabilize your joints appropriately in that range. And so you have these two contrasts, and I'm just giving this as an example. But you have this, let's say, a dancer climber or gymnast climber and a gorilla climber. And the problem is that each one of them probably needs a little bit of the other skill set. So if you're climbing very statically, very spread, you probably need to cut loose and get dynamic and you know, change your energy systems and change how you climb a little bit. And if you're, you know, if you're overpowering everything and you're very muscly, well, you probably have to slow down at stages and be a little bit, you know, be a little bit more static. And one of the keys I find is almost stereotyping each individual and finding which aspects of their individual attributes they're drawn to. Even if it's certain types of climbs, oh, I always do slab climbs. Oh, I love roofs, you know, whatever it is, but starting to train in their arsenal, some of their other, types of skill sets or climbs that they haven't used.
So, before we carry on, can you, explain the term energy systems to me? I mean, I understand it, as you're using it in context. I'm curious how it, just to define it, how it pertains to climbing or how, you know, like what, just kind of what that means for climbers, if anybody else is curious, because I again, understand it in context, but you've used it a couple times, so I'm kind of curious.
So I'll break it down even more simply. If you think about it, let's split climbing into bouldering, route climbing, and then let's just say route climbing, let's split that into maybe sport and trad. So or traditional climbing. So if you think about it, when you're training for bouldering, you're really thinking about this is more power. You have contact strength, you have the ability when you throw to a powerful move or a hold that you can stick it quickly. And you're normally like, how many moves would you say in the typical boulder problem that you just set?
8 to 12.
All right, so you've got 8 to 12 moves, you know, in a typical boulder problem. Well, now let's shift. And how long would you say, and let's say, how long would it take a climber to get through a boulder problem if they're able to, you know, progress smoothly through each move?
45 seconds to a minute, I guess, because, you know, you can run training programs on minute boulder problems. So, you know, 30 seconds to a minute.
All right, so let's say 30 seconds to a minute bouldering. And then let's switch to some route climbing. And how long do you think duration wise, you'd set the cap for route climbing?
I guess, I mean, it depends on the height of wall, but you know, you could be on the wall for 10 minutes.
Yeah. And I'd say even like sport climbing, I probably cut that number down. But yeah, let's say sport climbing and I'm just ballparking this stuff. Let's say you can go up, you know, 5 minutes on a route, and then trad climbing. Typically it takes a lot longer. It's a lot slower. You have to place gear. And let's say you can go up to 10 minutes on a route. So when you talk about energy systems and you're talking about training, how you train or how you rehabilitate or try and prevent injury should actually mirror the style of climbing and the types of climbing that you're training for. But as we talked about before, it should also fill in some of the gaps or some of the holes for the energy systems or the styles of climbing that you don't necessarily use. So for example, if you're bouldering consistently, maybe you train for power, right? If you're trad climbing consistently, maybe you train for endurance. If you're training for power, you're doing, you know, up to 6 repetitions of an exercise, like a supplementary exercise. If you're training for endurance, you're doing 12 plus repetitions. And you have this very specific type of training, but at some stage you may need to complement it with the other, per se.
Yeah. This is really interesting hearing you talk about this because I think it was a discussion I had with Ander Rockstad. And Ander was talking about how he trains for boulder problems, and he's very analytical. If you've heard that episode, the guy is, he thinks about everything to the nth degree when he's training. And he was up in Alaska working, and he was only at a hangboard, but he was training for a specific project. And he broke it down to knowing how big each hold was, how long he spent on that hold between moves, and started training his body
to be able to apply the same sort of pressure on the hands and on the same hold for the same duration. And that's how he was training for that specific boulder problem. And it's really interesting to hear you kind of talk about training almost that specifically in you know, per sport, but he obviously takes it even further per boulder problem. But yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's sport specificity. And it's really important to be able to train and focus on that. But then the thing to remember from an injury prevention standpoint is you kind of need the whole picture as well, or the entire picture as well. So you can't just only train so specifically, you know, on that depth of hold, on that exact amount of time, on that problem that you're going to be crimping. You do that, but you need to supplement that with something that's a little bit more holistic so you don't get hurt. So you don't only train those types of parameters.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about injury prevention then, because a lot of climbers go into the gym and they train. You know, a lot of climbers have no training plan whatsoever. They're just, you know, they read something in Dead Point or Climbing, or they look up a training program online and they just want to get stronger. And that's like their goal. You know, I just want to get stronger. And so they go in and they just essentially, you know, rapid fire some 4x4s or some minute boulder problems, or, do a handful of pull-ups, you know, work on their one arm pull-ups, you know, without a good plan. What do you think is a good way to approach it? Obviously everybody needs different things and needs to be more specific, to them, but in general, you know, what sort of advice do you have for, injury prevention while training?
Like, my biggest piece of advice is make it easy for yourself. Like, you can get in the most complicated position, have, you know, the tons of different crazy tools and be doing an exercise, and the likelihood of you repeating that consistently is pretty low. But if you have an exercise that's specific for injury prevention, I'm going to go over some of these on the podcast, and it's really easy to set up. You can do it anywhere. You know it's going to help because it's supported by research, and you don't have to buy anything extra to do it. Then that is the big thing. And it's not necessarily knowing what to do, but it's actually doing it, which I've found is the key. Yeah. And so what we could talk about, one big thing that I'm a huge proponent of is what I call dirtbag tips. But, you know, I was a dirtbag climber. I quit my job and I traveled to South America and I went climbing full time. And that was probably the best years of my life with no responsibilities. But I remember I wouldn't spend any money on anything unless it was climbing gear related.
Yeah.
And even if it was like, I remember, you know, I was doing a lot of rock climbing in alpine environments. And, you know, I remember, like, even, you know, when it was warm outside, I still had my like 0 degree bag because I didn't want to, you know, buy a second sleeping bag. And I had like nuts and, you know, I had nuts and hexes because I didn't want to buy cams, and like everything I did like was, you know, I was just running stuff out and I was like, oh man. But anyway, everything I did, I had in mind that, like, you know, I'm not going to spend any money. I'm just going to climb. And what I want to put a little bit of focus on, and especially on this podcast for your listeners, is, all right, like, whatever is in your climbing bag or whatever's around the house, let's use that. And yeah, let's develop some climbing specific rehab exercises or injury prevention exercises.
So not even rehabbing injury, but even, let's just talk about staying healthy. What sort of, like, dirt bag tips do you have for climbers who, you know, just did 3 days, you know, climbing, whether it's in the gym or outside, or like maybe even just after, you know, after hard climbing, like, what should they be doing, and what, you know, what sort of dirtbag tips do you have for them in that respect?
All right. Yeah. Let's get into dirtbag tips. All right. So let's start. This is like my favorite discussion. Cause it's like, it took a lot of creativity on my end to be like, all right, I'm not going to buy something. What do I do?
Right.
Let's start with foot and ankle. Let's build our way up. So, John, so what do you think the most common foot and ankle injury is for climbers? And let's just say boulderers typically.
Rolled ankles.
You got it. So rolled ankles are super common for boulders. It's typically when you fall incorrectly and you fall on the outside of your foot and it rolls inwards. And so it's called an ATFL, a sprain, but it's just a rolled ankle is the most typical kind.
Yeah.
And we've all had that before, you know, from falls or people climbers who have bouldered. And so from an injury prevention standpoint, think about it. If your ankle rolls inwards, the muscle that you want to strengthen to prevent it from rolling inwards is the muscle that rolls it the opposite way.
Okay.
So that's going to be which way?
Outward.
Yeah, you got it. So rolling your ankle outwards, right? So the injury prevention exercise for this, typically what you'll do in a physiotherapy clinic is you'll sit down with your legs straight in front of you, almost like you're doing a hamstring stretch, or you can even sit in your chair, you know, with your knees bent, but you'll put a resistance band around your foot. You'll loop it underneath your opposite foot, and you'll press that band out back and forth, so your foot's moving outwards against the resistance of the band to strengthen the muscles that push it outwards.
Okay.
So that's like if you have a resistance band, if you are in a clinic or if you have access to one, that's what you would use, right? But what would you use if you don't have a band? Let's say you just got you're climbing your crag pack. What can you grab from your crag pack that you can use as some resistance to strengthen your ankle outwards?
Climbing rope? I don't know.
Climbing rope is an option, but it's pretty bulky, right?
Yeah.
If you think about it, you want something a little flatter. So some anchor webbing or tubular webbing, if you have some of that, or even just a sling, a nylon double length runner. You just loop that around your foot and you step on it with your other foot. And I usually tell, I'm going to say this just once, but just use retired gear if you're going to use it for rehab.
Okay.
Don't be stepping on that runner that's protecting your run out. Go ahead. You loop it under your foot. So it's on top of, let's say, your right foot in a loop. You put it underneath your left and then you just resist pressing outwards into that runner.
So I'm sure people run into issues with knees as well. I don't know. I personally have a knee injury right now that I've been dealing with that's just overuse from climbing and cycling and skateboarding and route setting and, and it's pretty much just overuse and my knees just hurt. And so as far as, people getting in drop knees, people hiking up to the crag and stuff like that, what should they be doing to keep their knee joints healthy?
Yeah, so let's say maybe we'll start with drop knees. So if you think about drop knees, think about your knee. All the knee is an articulation or a connection between your thigh bone and your shin bone. And then you have a patella or a kneecap on top of it. But you have a connection between your thigh bone and your tibia bone or your shin bone, and that's your knee. So if you trace your thigh bone, from your knee all the way up, you run into your hip joint. And when people get knee pain during drop knees, and that can cause some injury to what's called the meniscus, which is a fibrocartilage in between the knee.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times is what's happening is they don't have enough motion in their hip. And so as they're going into that drop knee, as they're rotating into the wall, their hip motion is stopping, and then the motion transfers into a torque into the knee. And so oftentimes what I'll tell climbers is if you stretch out the muscles in the front of your hip, especially in that if you're doing a drop knee, that's the leg that's behind you for sure that you're dropping down. If you stretch out those muscles in the front of your hip before you do that, that can take some stress off of your knee.
Okay.
So the one thing is stretching, and it's the muscles in the, in the thigh. One of them, it crosses your knee joint. So it's called the rectus femoris, but it attaches to your kneecap. It goes up through your thigh and it crosses the hip. And one way too, that you can start to loosen it up is you can do some stretches. But can you think of another way that you can almost break up muscle tissue to loosen it up a little bit other than just stretching?
Foam rolling.
Foam rolling, you got it.
And I know this because I had to go to PT for my knee.
Yeah, so you got all the answers. Yeah, exactly. Through experience, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So through foam rolling. So if you foam roll on that thigh muscle, the front of the thigh, and then you do some stretches for that hip, when you're in a drop knee position, that can unload your knee quite a bit. Now, here's the tricky part. How big's a foam roller?
Yeah, no, huge. And when I traveled to South Africa, I couldn't bring it with me, right? Because it's like, I mean, I could, but it's just cumbersome. So this is the problem.
You have to like check luggage, you know, to bring to bring a foam roller. And that's taking up some valuable real estate and, you know, and what you can actually bring on your climbing trips. So any thoughts, think in your climbing bag, let's say, all right, man, we can't use a foam roller. Anything you think you can use to, you know, work on that muscle, to break up that muscle?
I don't know. I don't know.
So what I found is actually if you take a retired carabiner and you grip it almost like brass knuckles.
Okay.
You know, so you take the carabiner, put your hand through it, you grip it like brass knuckles, you put some sunscreen on your thigh, right? Uh-huh. Because we're not using fancy soft tissue mobilization cream. We're just using what we have in our bag. And you take that carabiner and that soft tissue suntan lotion, and you can start to break up that muscle a little bit more aggressively than if you just used your hands.
That's crazy. So, I mean, you just essentially like doing like a deep tissue massage with carabiner and sunscreen.
You got it. Carabiner deep tissue massage.
Cool. All right.
So, and you want to use a retired carabiner because, you know, then the carabiner gets all greasy and you're cruxing out and you can't open the gate because you just used some suntan lotion massage oil. So don't be complaining to me about that. Use some retired gear.
For sure.
Hey friends, I just wanted to take a second and tell you about this episode's sponsor, Climbs.com. Climbs is a route management and gym member engagement platform that allows gym managers, head route setters, and even gym members to keep track of and engage with the route inventory of their climbing gyms. I have seen a handful of these apps and websites. I've talked to people who are working on them, but none of them are quite as successful or all-encompassing as Climbs.com. It even allows gyms to run climbing leagues, put on paperless competitions, and it allows members to track their sessions and provide feedback for the gym using the online platform or their new iPhone app that they just came out with, which is really cool. So if you guys want to add another great element to your climbing gym, check out climbs.com. That's spelled KLIMBZ.com. Or you can email them at info@climbs.com. You can even go to our website at ctclimbingpodcast.com and find links that will take you right there. So check them out. I promise you won't be disappointed. And now back to the show.
As we move through these, I think, you know, one of the ones I think all the listeners would be really interested in, or there's two really specifically, and, you know, feel free to throw in any other injury dirtbag prevention tips or whatever. But I know that all the listeners want to hear about shoulders and fingers because that's like the biggest or most common injuries, I think, is everybody, you know, everybody hurts their shoulder at one point. Everybody tears a finger or injures their fingers. So I want to definitely touch on those and focus on any dirtbag tips you have and also what people should be doing to avoid injury to their shoulders and fingers.
Great. So let's start maybe with fingers. So finger injuries, the most common finger injuries, and there's a lot of them that you can have in the finger, but the most common is going to be a pulley sprain. Most climbers have heard that before, but there's a ligament that, or there's several of them. There's five different ones in the finger that wrap around that connect down your tendon to the bone, or keep your tendon in your finger secured to the bone, almost like the eyelets on a fishing pole, or almost like a quick draw. You know, keeps the rope close to the wall.
Right.
And those are called your pulleys. And there's five annular pulleys in the finger, which are the most commonly injured ones. And the other thing is the flexor tendon, so your finger flexor. So when you grip and your muscle from your forearm, then in the front of your forearm travels down into tendons that go into the finger, and some of those tendons in a finger can become injured or have a tendinopathy from, you know, from overuse or from one particular move that strained them. So that's a, those are common finger injuries. And the way to prevent them, have you had any finger injuries yourself, John?
Too many.
Too many. All right. Which ones have you injured the most?
Definitely ring finger.
Yeah. Ring finger is one of the most commonly injured fingers. And one thing I'll have listeners try. So it's pretty easy to go online and find like pretty standard protocols for rehabbing and preventing finger injuries. Uh-huh. But one thing that I've been playing with, which is quite interesting, is if everyone who's listening, and if you're driving, don't do this, but everyone other than driving, if you put your finger down or your hand down on the table in front of you and you keep your wrist straight, are you able to do this right now, John?
Yeah, I'm doing it.
All right. And lift your thumb only. Okay. Lift your pointer finger only.
Okay.
Lift your middle finger only, lift your ring finger only, and lift your pinky. Were you able to do all those?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Now go ahead and do that same thing, but I want you to now extend your wrist back. So almost like you're stretching your forearm.
Okay.
And
so palm on the table. Wrist
yeah, this
bent?
Is easier like if you're standing. So it's basically like palm on the table, but you're standing and your wrist is almost like in a wrist stretch.
Okay, yeah.
And so like your elbow is like right over your wrist. Does
and I can't move any of my fingers.
And you can't move any of your fingers, right?
Yeah.
There's a reason for this. But that's a test that I've been playing with. And now split the difference. Find that position where you can actually lift some of your fingers, but you can't lift other ones.
Okay. It's about 45 degrees plus or minus.
Okay, so 45 degrees. And is there one finger that's harder for you to lift than the others?
Yeah, the ring finger for sure. I can do the pinky, middle finger, pointer, and thumb, but I can't lift my ring finger.
Yeah, but you can't lift your ring finger. And it's a coincidence that ring finger is the one that you've injured, you know, more often, right?
Yeah.
So there's actually there's some biological reasons. There's some extensor muscles in the fingers that only lift the pointer finger, and there's some stronger muscles and tendons in the middle finger as well. But it's a fun thing that I like to do for climbers because you can do it at work, you can do it anytime, but to start to train to differentiate your fingers and lift each finger individually. So these are the extensor muscles or the muscles that can protect the ligaments and tendons in the front of our fingers. And to start to train how to individually lift each finger and then eventually to do that against some type of resistance or in a greater angle.
So this is kind of the same idea as using those power fingers or using a rubber band or something like that and essentially stretching your fingers out in a way, like the using those opposite muscles from climbing, right?
Yeah, it's a way kind of like, you know, and you give allude to, yeah, you put a rubber band or power fingers around your fingers and you strengthen those extensor muscles or those antagonist muscles. That's one thing. But if you think about it, you're doing that and you're doing all of them at once, right?
Uh-huh.
This is a more isolated way to just use your own body tension to create the resistance. And then isolate your ability to differentiate just the fingers that aren't extending well independently.
Okay.
So it's a little more specific way to prevent injuries or train some of the finger extensors.
Okay. Very cool.
And you bring mention to using power fingers or rubber bands. I believe most climbers are familiar with that. John, do you want to talk through what you would do with a band to prevent your finger injuries? And I can build upon that.
Yeah, this will be fun because I'll tell you what I do and then you'll tell me why it's not working.
All right.
No, what I usually do is take just like one of those like blue asparagus rubber bands or something that you get with like asparagus or broccoli. And I'll, you know, just kind of do some light warm-ups. I put it on, the middle of my fingers. So not all the way at the tips, just the middle, and just kind of do stuff, you know, lightly open my hands a handful of times, both hands. And then, we'll move it to the tips of my fingers, to get a little bit more, leverage on those. And then, I also have been told, and again, this is climbers just telling other climbers how to do things, that doctors should probably be telling you. but put the rubber band on your thumb, give it a twist so that the thumb is kind of wrapped up, and then put the other four fingers just open in the rubber band and use it that way. So I don't know, you know, just doing things other climbers tell me.
All right. No, that's good. I mean, that's a really good foundation for it. So when you're pressing out into the band with your fingers, how long are you holding it for?
I guess it's fairly rapid, maybe less than a second when I'm opening them up.
Less than a second. And then, John, do you hangboard or fingerboard?
Not currently. I got a finger injury. Well,
it's, okay. Or let's say in the past.
Yeah, definitely.
How long would you hang for?
If I'm just doing hangboards and not campus board, like hangboard, I would do usually 5 seconds on, 5 seconds off, 10 times. Okay.
So you'll do 5 seconds on, 5 seconds on a hangboard. But you'll do 1 second on, 1 second off for your finger extensor exercises.
Right.
And then, do you mostly boulder, route climb? Like what do you do mostly?
Mostly boulder. Yeah.
Mostly boulder. How long would you say the duration is, typically how long your hand is on a move when you boulder?
5 to 10 seconds, plus or minus.
All right. So let's say, yeah, about five to 7 seconds, let's say. So I'm just going to just link these all together. So when you climb, your finger muscles are usually engaged for about 5 to 7 seconds. When you fingerboard, your hang times are usually about 5 seconds. And then when you do your injury prevention exercises, your hold times are about a second.
I love it when you break things down to the point where it's like, oh, yeah, obviously.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's where we talk about, okay, let's start to have our injury prevention exercises catch up to our knowledge with training.
Yeah.
And, you know, most climbers that I'd say, like, most gym climbers are pretty well in tuned with training. Like, that's kind of a part of the culture. That's part of, you know, climbing, especially the gym climbing culture. I'd say outdoor climbers, it's some are, some aren't. Like, it's a little bit, it depends on travel schedule, really.
Yeah.
It's really hard to train if you're always traveling, especially a lot of the pros that I work with. But if you think about it, you got to start connecting those dots. And it's not rocket science. It may just be a simple thing where you just need to start turning on those finger extensor muscles the same way that you turn on your flexors and the same way that you climb.
That's really interesting. So is this something we should be doing as a warm-up? Is this something we should be doing after climbing as far as working those extensors?
Yeah, so prior to climbing, there's a concept of muscle activation, these are more tendons that are in our fingers, but they're attached to muscles. And one of the theories, if you think about it, is before you climb or before you do some type of sporting activity, you want to be able to turn on or preheat or activate the injury prevention muscles before you get on the wall, because that's going to increase the likelihood of using them. Does that make sense? So,
yeah.
So if you think about it, before you get on the wall is the prime time to do non-fatigable, which I call activation exercises. So if you do those finger extensors with a band that we're talking about, and you do those and you're pumping out and you're fatiguing and then you go and climb, that probably is not going to be as effective as if you do a light resistance band for a 5 to 7 second hold if you're bouldering. It's going to be longer if you sport or trad climb.
Uh-huh.
And then you rest probably about 3 to 4 seconds, because that's how long it takes to transition to your next hold. Then you engage again. And you do that for 8 to 12 times or however many, you know, moves you're anticipating are on your boulder problem. And doing 3 sets of that is going to give you the best likelihood of pre-engaging those muscles before you climb. But the key is you can't do it to fatigue. And this is prior to climbing. This is part of your warm-up.
So I guess before we move on to shoulders, with finger injury prevention, I mean, what's the best thing to do aside from just, you know, strengthening your extensors? Because I feel like people overclimb, they don't listen to their bodies, you know, they're not doing their finger extensor exercises. They, you know, there's a lot of things that climbers do wrong. And a lot of it, like you, when you were starting, a lot of it is just psych. Like, you just want to be there doing it. And
yeah,
so
definitely.
So what, you know, I guess to avoid injury in fingers, what sort of advice do you have other than just, you know, strengthening those extensors?
I mean, the obvious one is listen to your body, right? Know your body warning sign and know what can be something that is dangerous or detrimental, or what can be something that is, you know, safe and you're able to continue to climb through. But so I see a lot of rock climbers as my patient population, and I see a lot of climbers that have what's called failed conservative therapy, which means they've seen two or three other, you know, physical therapists or chiropractors or athletic trainers or whoever the medical professional is. I typically see them like later down the line. They're like, all right, I need to figure this out. and so all the basics are covered. Like they're doing finger extensor exercises. They're stretching their fingers or warming up with tendon glides before they get on the wall. They're doing muscle activation work for their hands. You know, all this stuff they've done some like analyzing of, okay, don't over crimp, you know, don't grip too hard while on the wall, modify your positioning, all that stuff. So what I'll typically do, I'll have them, you know, get into a hands and knees position or almost like a quadruped position on the ground, and then put the weight into their toes. So it's almost like now you're imagining the ground's a rock wall. And I'll just analyze how they're actually moving and put a large emphasis in the shoulder blade, because that's really the connection of our hands and their fingers down into the, you know, into the torso and into our body. And so I start with almost like a zoomed out view and start to say, okay, is there anything going wrong in the shoulder blade? Is there any type of asymmetry in the shoulders that is leading to this? And then I'll get video footage of them climbing and say, okay, is there anything going on in the lower body, the lower quarter, in their footwork? Are there any almost like repetitive movement patterns over time that I can see that can stress the fingers? And that's where I find a lot of the stuff that people miss, is just taking a step back from the hand itself and saying, okay, the hand is the conduit or the connection to the rock wall, but what is the rest of the body doing that's causing stress?
So this is one thing that I struggle with, and I'm sure a lot of people do, is we listen to a podcast episode where, you know, a PT or a climbing coach or a trainer is telling you, you know, that they are analyzing your technique or they're looking for your weaknesses and stuff like that. But, you know, not everybody has the access to this. So how can people assess themselves? Like, how do we know what's right and what's wrong, you know, when you're looking at technique on the wall and stuff like that?
Yeah. So from a simplistic standpoint, so, you know, let's say you, like John, you're a male. So we'll say your shirt is off. You're in this you're in this climbing position. You know, if you're female, you're in a tank top or something that exposes your shoulder blades. Like that's really important to be able to see that. And like, try this on yourself or get a buddy or take a, you know, a camera and shoot from overhead, you know, rig it somehow. But what I normally will take climbers through is I'll have them in that position and I'll look at their shoulder blade. And let's say from an advanced medical perspective, I'll tell you what I'm looking for. And then from the most likely occurrence, like, so anyone can look, I'll tell you what you would typically see. But does that maybe paint a picture? So you get the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
So if you look at the shoulder blade, it should be about 3 inches. The inside border should be 3 inches from the midline of the spine. And it should be attached to the spine. It shouldn't be winging or pulling away. It should be flush, you know, with the spine and with the torso.
Okay.
So that's its resting position. And the top angle of it should be aligned with what's called, especially when your hands are a little bit overhead, should be aligned with C7 or T1, which is basically the C7's like that giant bump that sticks out of the back of your neck.
Okay.
So that's just, those are your like parameters, almost like your, you know, does your shoulder blade fall within these areas? So you can have a friend or buddy, or you can videotape, or you can watch this. And so then what you do is you go into that position, then you reach one arm in front of you and you start to look in the shoulder and you compare this side to side. The most common thing that you'll see is the shoulder blade's going to wing away from the body. And that inside angle of the shoulder blade is going to peel away, and it's called winging. If you look up Google Images and type shoulder blade winging, you'll see exactly what I mean.
Okay.
But you'll get some of that winging of the shoulder blade. And that means that some of the muscles, it's called serratus anterior is the main one, is not keeping that shoulder in its place. So all you do, you look at one side versus the other. And if you see some of that winging of the shoulder blade on the side that you keep injuring your finger, well, then you probably need to initiate some exercises to strengthen that muscle that stabilizes your shoulder and then utilize it when you climb. Now, that's just one way. So that's like the quick hit, you know, that's one pattern.
Right.
But if you think about it, the shoulder blade can go multiple ways. So it can go too far upwards, too far downwards, too far in, too far out, too far rotated up or too far rotated down. So you then, you know, from an advanced perspective, then you could say, oh, well, I'm actually looking for six things in the shoulder blade, but the most common one is going to be that one I just mentioned.
Gotcha. So, okay, so let's, for the sake of time, let's move on to shoulders and talk about shoulder injuries, because okay. I thankfully have been very lucky to not knock on wood, or to knock on wood, like not have any shoulder injuries thus far. But I know a ton of people who, you know, even have, you know, small tweaks or impingements or whatever to people who have had to have full surgery. And, you know, like listening to other podcasts, like Chris Hampton had his shoulder injury and Neely Quinn had a shoulder injury. And, you know, you just hear about it from climbers all the time. And I think shoulders are, you know, we twist them and turn them and gas stone on them and cross under them. And, you know, we do so much with the shoulders as climbers that I think it's really important to figure out how to strengthen them and, you know, try and keep those shoulders injury free.
Yeah. So some of it comes down to, and all, I'm kind of utilizing this podcast to say almost like, try and do my best to give almost more individualized advice, because almost anyone right now can look online and say, okay, climbing shoulder injury, do some, you know, eyes, Y's and T's, do some wall angels, you know, do some stretching of the chest muscle. You know, there's a lot of information on like what to do in general.
Yeah.
But knowing there's a lot of specificity when it comes to the shoulder is important. So if you think about the shoulder joint, I don't know how many climbers listening right now golf. I definitely do not golf, but I spent a lot of time learning the mechanics of golf because of some of my patients. But if you think about golf, you have a golf tee and a golf ball, and the golf ball is quite larger. It's actually four times larger than the golf tee, the surface area.
Okay.
That's actually our shoulder. So our shoulder is a golf ball on a golf tee. The humeral head is four times larger than the acetabulum, or the space that it cups into. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So in general, the shoulder is quite mobile. And I say that in general because I'm going to break this down into two different categories. But if you have something that's quite mobile, it leaves you susceptible to injuries because you have a large range that you're moving it through. Just like you said with climbing, you have to Gaston, you have to reach overhead, you have to, you know, do all these different types of movements. So it leaves the shoulder a little bit susceptible. So if we look at shoulder pain in general, first thing you have to do is determine, are you someone who's stiff or are you someone that's mobile? And most of us can pretty much, you know, identify this on ourselves. But the test for this, and a lot of people think that they're mobile, but they actually have quite a bit of stiffness, is the test on this is you lie on your back and you bend your knees. So your feet are like flat on the floor, right?
Okay.
And then you raise your arm up overhead while keeping your elbow fully straight, and you try to touch your thumb to the ground. Now, most people can do this, I'd assume, right?
Right.
You're just lying on your back. You keep your elbow straight. You touch your thumb to the ground. And this is a test I do in the clinic all the time. Now, I have climbers do that. And then I go in and I press down on one area of the body. And they do it again. And they can barely get that thumb to touch. What do you think the area that I press down on is?
I'm not sure. Chest? Or
close. A little bit lower.
Their stomach?
Yeah. So the ribs. I take the ribs and I press them downwards. So I almost like if their stomach was turning on and activating. Okay. So I press their ribs downward, which flattens their back. And then they reach and they can't touch, you know, their thumb to the floor. And so what this is a test of and how this relates to climbing is a lot of times we reach beyond our flexibility limits. And that climber, if they're going to be climbing and they're on a roof and they have to reach over a head and they're going to try and get a route, what do you think they're going to do with their rib cage and their back to try and get that extra motion?
Yeah, they'll be stretching out all the way and flattening, yeah.
Yeah, or no, they'll be stretching all the way, but they'll be arching their back, flaring their ribs, which actually brings our center of mass closer into the rock wall, which is helpful, but it takes away our core strength. You almost imagine have your arm in the air, like all the way in the air, and now arch your back really far. Your rib cage flares up, your back arches. That takes away your core strength, and then it pushes your shoulder beyond its actual range of motion. And then the second they have to engage their core to do a tough move and create tension, they tighten their core, their rib cage locks down. Now their arm is way behind them.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so it's a simple test that like surprises a lot of people. They're like, oh, I thought I was so mobile. And all I do is I have them exhale, push down their ribs with their hands and just try and touch their thumb to the floor. And that actually becomes their warm up for their shoulder.
Interesting. Okay. That's so crazy. There's so much information, but I guess that's why you wrote a book. So
yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. So there's tons of information, tons of content out there. I think in general for climbers, here's the thing: try and fix your own injuries, like you know, or prevent injuries by doing the right things to fix them. But if you have a serious injury or something that's really bugging you, it may be helpful to find a local physical therapist or chiropractor or occupational therapist or somebody that's a medical professional that can help you with that. And if they're a climber, that's huge.
Like yeah. So that's one thing I was going to ask is what advice do you have for trying to just find the right PT? That's it. You know, I mean, there's tons of physical therapists out there and they're all very well versed and learned in their field. And they know, like you said, biomechanics and how the body works and stuff. But I mean, I have stories from friends who, you know, have gone to hand doctors and PTs and they, you know, they just don't, I don't think they understand fully what's needed for climbing or what's necessary. And I think a lot of that is missed, which is why it's great that, you know, physical therapists like yourself are focusing on climbing. But when people go out to find a PT, like what should they be looking for?
Well, I mean, that was actually a big part of this book that I put out was I was getting so many messages for climbers. I actually don't have – I would love to see, all the climbers that write to me and that, you know, try and set up and schedule appointments. But my time is spread so thin that I'm constantly referring to who's local, who's in that area. Mm-hmm. And there are so many good physical therapists. You know, the field has really progressed. There are tons of good physical therapists that are local to these climbers. The main issue that I get is even though they're great physical therapists, they don't understand climbing. And yeah. So the purpose of this book actually was saying, hey, as a climber, get this book, take it to your physical therapist or your medical professional, you know, whoever's under your care. If they don't know climbing,
yeah,
have them look through it, read, educate, and then they can take their expertise and then apply it to now their knowledge of rock climbing that you gave them. And that was one of the things. And then the second is, well, if you can't afford to see someone, well, here's some options on how to prevent and rehabilitate your own injuries.
Right. So I guess, is there anything about the book that you want to talk about specifically that we haven't covered? Because obviously, you know, all this information that we've kind of talked about is like just general stuff. But you put this book out, so with the intention to educate people on injury prevention and so on and so forth. So I know you've put a lot of thought into it. Is there anything specific about the book and why people should read it?
I think the big thing about the book is the goal is let's break down climbing and injury prevention and rehabilitation into a system. And the book takes through a system, which I call the Rock Rehab Pyramid, but it takes you through a step-by-step way to prevent or rehabilitate any injury. And you can take all the exercises from the book, or if there's exercises that you like that you've been using as injury prevention, you can put them into this system. That's quite simple. And you can use that to then progress from the bottom of the pyramid is this pain, inflammation, tissue overload stage. The second level is mobility. The third level is strength. And then the final level is integrating that all into climbing movement. So I think the big thing is I'm a huge proponent for climbers self-treating, but when you get into an issue where, you know, you're having pain or it's beyond your control, you probably need to see a medical professional. Right. But at least having the resource to know what to do is big and is a huge passion project. I'm so psyched on it. Actually, the first print run sold out. So the new books come in I think in about 2 more weeks. I'm hoping, it should be by the time you put this podcast up, those will be available. But it's been big, and it's the book. I had a lot of climbers help me with it. Sasha Julian is featured in the book. Jonathan Segrist, Sean McColl, Josh Levin is in the book as well. I know you know him quite well.
Yeah.
And they're all huge with, they shot all the photos. We did videos that linked to the book and just getting this whole message out there. It's been a pretty amazing experience.
Wow. That's really cool. So I don't know if we've mentioned it, in the podcast yet. What's the name of the book?
Oh, that'd probably be helpful. So the name of the book is Climb Injury Free, and you can get it. It's available on Amazon, or it should be available when this podcast airs. And it's also available on the climbingdoctor.com webpage. And then doctor is spelled out D-O-C-T-O-R.
Cool. Yeah. And I'm going to have all of this information on the episode page as well, with links to your website and the Amazon site and, you know, whatever else, whatever other information, I'll have all that on the episode page so people can find it at, ctclimbingpodcast.com. So yeah. Jared, we could talk for hours, I'm sure. And I hope we get the chance to do it again in the future. Maybe we can do some more specific, podcast episodes and really dive deep into it. But, in the meantime, it's been great having you on.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
And that is it for this episode of Chalk Talk Climbing Podcast. Make sure to visit the episode page for links, pictures, show notes, and more. Stay tuned after this episode to hear about the lovely patrons who help to support this podcast. And if you'd like to be a patron as well, just head over to the Patreon link on our website and support for as little as $1 a month out of your checking account. I bet you won't even notice that it's gone, and you'll be helping keep Chalk Talk rolling. I have a great episode coming for you guys next. I'm super excited about it, and I can't wait for you to hear it. But in the meantime, this is John Blomquist. See you next time. Over and out. Okay, I just wanted to give a big shout out to those of you who are supporting Chalk Talk through Patreon. So far, you badass patrons are Ms. Briarly McCubbins, Perry Brooks Randall, Kelly Wyckoff, Nicholas Balancio, Ian Robinson, and Cameron Craig. You guys are the people who are keeping this podcast rolling, and I can't thank you enough. For those of you who are donating over $5 a month, I am going to be sending out stickers and handwritten letters to you guys shortly, so keep an eye out for that. Again, thank you so much, and if you who are not listening want to be a patron, again, head over to our website at ctclimbingpodcast.com and just click on the Patreon link. Again, it just comes out of your checking account each month, and you can do as little as a dollar a month. You guys can do $10,000 a month if you really want to. I would appreciate it. But seriously, thank you to those who are donating, and I will see you guys on the next episode.